Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So this is a talk, although I wrote it for this retreat, it's my obsession, so I could have probably done it. If you woke me at 3 in the morning and told me to talk about this, I probably could have done so. It's really about human fragility and vulnerability, and it's not just human, as you'll see. If it really were true that we're only machines, then disease and death would be unproblematic. You'd throw away a machine that doesn't work. Machines don't last forever. They break. Our bodies might be machine-like in some respects, but that doesn't help us when we think of ourselves as people. So let me start with an anecdote. This is the outline of the talk. We have a lot to cover. Okay, so first an anecdote. I was a very, very green medical student on the medical wards. They had medical wards when I was there at Washington University School of Medicine. There was a 14-year-old patient by the name of Sylvester, who was known to all the medical services at the large university hospital. He had sickle cell anemia. And that sickle cell anemia, not trait, mind you, full-blown sickle cell anemia. And I think, as many of you are aware, most cases of sickle cell anemia are due to a point mutation in the beta chain of hemoglobin. It's a single nucleotide change in the DNA causes a change in one amino acid from glutamic acid to valine, and this leads to an abnormal kind of hemoglobin that stacks up and makes red blood cells rigid and makes them form sickle shapes. So here's a blood smear of a patient with sickle cell anemia, and I think the sickle cells are clear enough, and there are some other findings on this slide as well. Now, the problem here is that the sickled cells don't deform properly, so they clog blood vessels, and that causes all sorts of problems clinically. It's not completely understood why, but there's a fairly wide range in the severity of the symptoms of this disease. Some patients do relatively well, let me underscore relatively, but Sylvester had a horrible case, the worst anybody had ever seen. In addition to the anemia, he also had frequent episodes called pain crises. These are caused, this severe pain, caused by clogs in the small blood vessels, mainly of the bones and bone marrow and joints. He had other symptoms too. In addition to the anemia, he had multiple infections, small stature, vision problems because of the severity of the pain. He also got pain medications, and then he developed a dependency on the drugs. He developed some odd symptoms that were very hard to account for. For example, he once had a weird kind of paralysis, transient paralysis, and the question was whether this was due to some lesion in his brain or was psychiatric. And, you know, this was way back before there were CAT scans and MRIs and all that fancy stuff. The considered opinion at the time was that it was psychiatric, but who knows? Well, another symptom he had was this one, dactylitis, painful as can be. You can see the swelling in the right hand of this poor child. Now, before we get to some theological approaches to why a child like Sylvester has to suffer so much, let's consider two further points about the biology. Now, as I'm sure many of you are aware, people get sickle cell anemia if they have two mutant copies of the gene, two alleles, mutant alleles. But if a person only has one such allele, that person is actually protected against malaria. In terms of the cold, hard math of the genetics, this phenomenon is known as a balanced polymorphism. There's actually a biological survival to the population, mind you, not to the individual, of people living in the malaria zone of Africa, mainly the central and west regions that are endemic for the Plasmodium falciparum malarial parasite. The trade-off, to put this as coldly as possible, is that if the sickle hemoglobin gene is widely prevalent in the population, some people will die of sickle cell anemia, but even more will survive malaria. So on balance, it's a kind of a so-called win, a survival advantage. Now, balanced polymorphisms are not limited to human beings by any means. It's also been shown in plants and animals, and here's one in the grove snail that has a balanced polymorphism that gives it a variety of camouflage patterns. Now, one last point, and one can debate whether the hemoglobin S gene is horrible or not in the context of malaria. But remember that this was a kid living in St. Louis, not Africa. And just think, this horrible disease, and I mean sickle cell anemia, not malaria, is caused by a change of one stupid nucleotide, all right? Adenine to thymine, one stupid nucleotide. GAG encodes glutamate, and GTG encodes valine. How incredibly easy it would be to change it back to what it ought to be. Now, when I say easy, I'm exaggerating, obviously. Not easy, but definitely within sight at present. But this, after all, is genetic engineering. Gasp. Should we do it? Should we do it? Well, let me tell you, this has been approved in the United Kingdom, and it's about to be approved in the United States. So the question then arises, what should be the limits? Should we do it? How far should we go in this kind of thing? Now, to come a little bit to the theological questions, did God really need to create the parasite Plasmodium falciparum that causes malaria? And if so, was hemoglobin S really the best way to protect children against it? Or let's put this another way. Did God create the world such that human children are no more or less valuable than Plasmodium falciparum? Now, as some of you may know, not something hidden, one of my favorite novels is Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. And in order to go on to the next part of my talk, I need to give you some background for those of you who haven't read it. And as I said yesterday, if you haven't, correct this error. Okay, so Brothers Karamazov. Dostoevsky was quite explicit in calling this a novel about children. It's his last and by common assent his greatest novel. Children do figure into one of the subplots of the novel. It's the story, if you've read it, of Ilyusha Snegiryov, the son of Captain Snegiryov. But aside from this subplot, there are two other main ways that children come into the novel. The first is that the three Karamazov brothers, and not to give too much of a spoiler, possibly a fourth one, were once children themselves, and they were not treated very well. The action of the novel starts when the three brothers, who grow up mostly apart and mostly away from their parental home, meet and get to know each other as adults at their father's home. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to say very little about the oldest brother, Dmitri, and I'll turn instead to the two younger brothers, Ivan and Alyosha. And by the way, Ivan and Alyosha were full brothers. Dmitri was a half-brother. Now, these two children, Ivan and Alyosha, had very different temperaments. At the start of the novel, Alyosha was a novice in the local monastery, and he was devoted to an elder named Father Zosima. Ivan, on the other hand, had a brilliant mind. He went to university through the generosity of some distant relations, and he studied the natural sciences there. He was, by reputation at least, an atheist, though I would say that the situation was not so simple as that. The reason that the brothers had spent little of their childhood together was, to put it simply, that their father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, well, let's put it bluntly, he was a low, degenerate swine, but I think that's a very unfair statement to the pigs. The personalities of Ivan and Alyosha were night and day. Alyosha was beloved by everyone and seemed to love everyone, though the narrator stresses that this doesn't mean he was a simpleton. Ivan, on the other hand, realized that he was living on the charity of others, and he grew up morose, withdrawn, resentful. And in the novel, Ivan and Alyosha meet again after this long separation, and they sit one evening in a tavern and get to know one another. And this occurs in three consecutive chapters, which form the theological and philosophical core of the novel. Now, these chapters are entitled, as you see on the bottom here, The Brothers Get Acquainted, Rebellion, and The Grand Inquisitor. I'm only going to talk about the first two of these, in which Ivan discusses the suffering of children. So this is the third way in which children enter the novel. Now, earlier in the novel, in the chapter called Over the Cognac, the father, Fyodor Pavlovich, is talking with these two sons, Ivan and Alyosha. And he asks, well, is there a God? And Ivan says, no, there is no God. Alyoshka, another form of the name Alexei, is there a God? There is. And okay, so on. And that would seem to settle the matter, okay? But then, later, in the tavern, Ivan says this, and I'm not going to read all of it, but he backtracks on his earlier statement, and he says, I said that on purpose yesterday at dinner with the old man just to tease you. And Alyosha, not being a simpleton, says, yes. So Ivan says, so imagine that perhaps I, too, accept God. And Alyosha, being not a simpleton, says, yes, of course, unless you're joking again. Fool me once, shame on you, you know, as they say. So we have two very different statements from Ivan, and one really does not know what Ivan thinks. And this is compounded by the fact that he has written an article described but not quoted in the novel, in which he defends the right of the church government over the state government. Now, in my opinion, the reason we don't know what Ivan thinks is exactly that Ivan does not know what Ivan thinks. He is completely confused. In spite of his intellectual brilliance, or maybe because of his intellectual brilliance, he's confused. And I think the one who summarized Ivan's view on God best was the elder, Father Zosima, who said that in Ivan, the issues of God and immortality were not yet resolved in his heart. As, mind you, make note of heart, not mind, okay? In his heart. As Zosima says to him, this idea is not yet resolved in your heart and torments it. Now, Ivan is a good rhetorician, and therefore, when he speaks to Alyosha in the tavern, he's really setting the stage for his own argument. I'm going to read this now. He says, and therefore I declare that I accept God pure and simple, but this, however, needs to be noted. If God exists, and if he indeed created the earth, then, as we know perfectly well, he created it in accordance with Euclidean geometry, and he created human reason with a conception of only three dimensions of space. Okay? Now, Ivan knows, and later states, not all geometry is Euclidean. And in fact, it was a Russian mathematician by the name of this man, Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky, who had around 1829 famously taken aim at Euclid's fifth postulate. And he developed what is called hyperbolic geometry. Now, those of you who are not so mathematically inclined, Euclid's fifth postulate basically is the one. Mathematicians were worried about it for a long time because they tried to prove it and never were able to. But basically, it's the one that says parallel lines never meet. And Lobachevsky said, well, maybe they do. Okay, that's basically, and he developed this thing called hyperbolic geometry. And the point being, this was in 1929, he published that Ivan, if you do the math, would have been a university student not long after that. and he would know Lobachevsky. So he knows very well that not all geometry is Euclidean. He knows this perfectly well. So why does Ivan suddenly play dumb, or at least ignorant, about something he must have known about? Well, this is, as I say, a rhetorical ploy. Joseph Frank, the great scholar of Dostoevsky, refers to this as the devil's swindle, trying to understand God in human terms. I mean, if God is omnipotent, he can create the world however he likes. He's trying to take God to task. To say that God created the world with Euclidean geometry is taking God to task for not allowing Ivan to understand it readily. Judging God by human standards. But of course, he's not really talking about geometry. The real topic is human suffering. Now, let me jump to the chase then and give you a statement of the problem of evil. And this one happens to be from Boethius in The Consolation of Philosophy. Boethius was a Christian in 5th century Rome, a time when Christians were periodically persecuted. And Boethius was a genuinely good man who was first exiled and then persecuted and then executed. And he wrote a book during his imprisonment, which is The Consolation of Philosophy. And he addresses a personification of philosophy. It's a woman who has a lot of the bearing of Athena, the goddess Athena. But here's his statement of the problem of evil. Si Deus est, unde malum? If God exists, whence evil? Now, most of you who know the problem of evil will know it in that form. But in fact, Boethius goes on, and a lot of people ignore the second half, and they really shouldn't. It's a bad mistake to ignore the second half. Si non est, unde bonum? If not, if God does not exist, where does the good come from? What is the good if there is no God? Is there such a thing as the good? Now, let me give you another. Let's enlarge the first part of this question. If God exists, and the usual part after it is, and is all good and all powerful. Sometimes people say all knowing, but I consider that part of being all powerful. And this is a statement from Lucretius on the nature of things, De Rerum Natura. And he got it from Epicurus. And it is quoted almost verbatim by David Hume in the Dialogues Concerning Religion. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? Okay. Now, in fact, Ivan goes even a little further than this in the next chapter, aptly entitled Rebellion. This chapter culminates when he famously returns the ticket to God. He claims that he accepts God but cannot accept the world made by God in which children are allowed to suffer. The whole question of what exactly he means when he says returns the ticket, that's a whole other lecture. When I teach the Brothers Karamazov, I spend a lot of time talking about that. But I think the title of the chapter, Rebellion, gives you the gist of it. Now, the chapter begins when Ivan says two things to the novice Alyosha. The first one runs directly counter to Christian doctrine. He notes that he finds it impossible to love one's neighbor. You can love people at a distance, but not as neighbors. I never could understand how it is possible to love one's neighbor. And then he launches into this story about a saint, John the Merciful. Now, there's a cute little thing that Dostoevsky did. I'll make a small digression here. This is not actually out of the life of John the Merciful. It is actually out of the life of Julien L'Hospitalier, Saint Julian, and Gustave Flaubert, wrote a great novella called La Légende de Julien L'Hospitalier. So Dostoevsky changed the name. Has Ivan changed the name? Why? Well, as you may know, Ivan is the Russian form of John. And John was a parricide, killed his father. So in a sense, he's insinuating, Dostoevsky is, that Ivan is also a parricide. Okay. And that's just by the way. But his main point in this discussion is to distinguish abstract love, love in general for humanity, versus real, individualized, practical love. Or as Father Zossima calls it, active love. Okay, meaning that it's not something one sits back and confers abstractly. It's something that one does in the world. Okay, now Ivan might really love children, and he claims here that he does love children. He says here, I mean to talk about the suffering of mankind in general, but better let us dwell on the suffering of children. That will reduce the scope of my argument about 10 times. Well, baloney. It'll actually make his argument easier, not harder. But nevertheless, it's a valid question. This is one of his rhetorical ploys. And he continues, one can love children even close up, even dirty and homely children. It seems to me, however, that children are never homely. You know, I think when you read the novel, you are likely to be surprised that Ivan loves children. But then he goes on and says something that is also surprising. He says, I will not speak of grown-ups because apart from the fact that they are disgusting, misanthropic, I would say, and do not deserve love, they also have retribution. They ate the apple and knew good and evil and became as gods, and they still go on eating it. But little children have not eaten anything and are not yet guilty of anything. Now, some of you might be surprised to saying that adults are guilty, but children are not guilty of anything. So I want to make a short digression now into the range of doctrines of original sin. Most of you are accustomed to, I imagine, to Augustine's very categorical view of original sin, including the contention that unbaptized infants go to hell as a consequence of original sin. Such infants, he noted, are guilty without having done anything themselves. And that was Augustine's interpretation of St. Paul's letter to the Romans, this verse that I'm sure you all know. And I think a lot of Augustine's views have been incorporated into the Western churches, but this is not the case for the Eastern Church. Eastern churches, including the Russian Orthodox Church, which takes a much less categorical view of original sin. In Eastern churches, one becomes guilty as one enters the world. In other words, children mature and enter adulthood, and then they adopt the ways of the world and become sinful. What we inherited from Adam, in other words, is a tendency towards sin. Now, when we come to the views of Thomas Aquinas, it turns out that they may be closer to that of the Eastern Church than to Augustine. Thomas calls original sin a habit. And in typical Thomistic fashion, he parses out the word habit into its different senses. But I've highlighted a couple of key points here. The second kind of habit is the disposition of a complex nature. Now, we're complex, we're not simple. We have both matter and spirit, but it's a disposition. And he says that whereby that nature is well or ill disposed to something, chiefly when such a disposition has become like a second nature, as in the case of sickness or health. In this sense, original sin is a habit. So the first sense of original sin is as a power, an active. The second is a habit. It's passive in a way. Now, second nature was, in fact, Augustine's term. It's from the City of God. And elsewhere, he wrote about the vitiation of our nature. And this kind of a geeky slide here, but I'm a full-fledged geek. In any case, so Thomas makes later in the same article, he talks about the difference between original sin and actual sin. He says, actual sin is an inordinate of act, whereas original sin, being the sin of nature, is an inordinate disposition of nature. And it's a, you know, it's kind of a subtle difference, but I think it's a very important one. And in this comment, in this quote, I'll show it again in red, Thomas inserted some comments about health and disease that, you know, perked up my ears, almost parenthetically, but I think he meant exactly what he said about health and disease. And it's a persistent metaphor in his writings, really. You find it a fair number of times. Original sin is the loss of original health and vigor. And I'll show these quotes, and I show these quotes again here in red. So he compared original sin to a sickness, as original sin is to health. Thomas's theory of physiology was humoral physiology straight out of Aristotle and Hippocrates. So when he refers to equilibrium, he means equilibrium of the humors. Now, I think we're all familiar with the argument that disease and death came into the world with original sin. So it's commonplace to take this to mean that death and disease are punishments for original sin. And I want to remind you that when we read the word punishment in Thomas Aquinas, in Latin it's pena, which can mean either pain or punishment, okay? It's not only punishment. And keep that in mind in the things that I say going forward. Now, I want to take you into my world, the world of science, and in particular the biological sciences. And in this particular world, statements like that of St. Paul and similar ones from Augustine raise a lot of problems, which lead most biologists, and there are polls to back this up, to reject statements like that of Paul as rubbish. Part of the conflict, I think, is that some theists, and I'll show one, this man, the Most Reverend James Usher, Archbishop of Armagh, Primate of all Ireland, and they take the Bible very literally, and I prefer the word concrete over literal. No, the Bible does not say, as Usher said, that the world began 6,000 or so years ago. This fallacious belief is actually rather modern, and he's the one that popularized it. Much of the blame goes to him for that. He calculated, using scripture, that the world began on October 22nd, 4004 BC. Okay, now, the fact that a day in Genesis is not necessarily 24 hours long, especially for the first 2 days when the sun wasn't created, this was only the beginning of the problems with Usher's calculations. Now, I'll leave this point aside. I think the bigger problem is that we were preceded by many, many creatures before us who harbored genes with an incredibly high degree of similarity to our own. This is one reason that experimental animals can model human diseases. Not only rats and mice, but even this worm at the beginning, and even bananas have a lot of genes homologous to our own, 60% by some estimates. And here's a favorite of mine, and let's see if I can do this. Oh, yeah, okay. That's C. elegans, a roundworm, nematode, C. elegans. Great model for neurodegenerative diseases. Okay, it does have a nervous system. So the point here is that any biologist is going to ask a question like this: how could disease and death have entered the world with Adam and Eve when Adam and Eve sinned if there were diseases and death long before that? Okay, this is a persistent question, even if one does not take Adam and Eve literally. And as I'm sure you are aware, the name Adam was not even originally a name. It was a Hebrew word called Adama, meaning ground or earth or soil. And Eve was also not a name, it was a word, Hava, which means to breathe, to give life, or to live. Now, beyond evolution, there's another problem, and this is related to Ivan Karamazov's problem. He worried about children, and this is the particular source of the power of his diatribe, because he talks about the suffering of children, and it's tough going through. It's really very graphic. But we can extend this to animals. And here's a cute dog. I have to show the cute dog. So it's a slightly cheesy slide, but as the author of the slide noted, I hope to be as good a person as my dog thinks I am, and I'll take half as good. So this is a question that C.S. Lewis examines in his book, The Problem of Pain, which includes a chapter on the problem of animal pain. He takes it very seriously. I don't agree with his conclusions, but he takes the problem very seriously. And I'll say, also on this slide, on the subject of animals, a must-read is Mary Midgley. And this is one of her books, she wrote several on animals and science, philosophy of science. But let's suppose that you're an Augustinian and you believe that even newborn babies are guilty of a sin. Why does this cute little dog have to suffer for the sins of Adam and Eve? I mean, they were human beings. I think one needs to do a lot of theological twisting and turning. You can say, for example, that all of nature fell because Adam and Eve fell. And indeed, that argument has been made. Now, let me come back to this. So this argument has been raised by a philosopher by the name of William Rowe. And here's the quote, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you'll get the gist of it. Suppose in some distant forest, lightning strikes a dead tree, and then there's a fire, and a fawn is trapped, horribly burned, and lies in terrible agony for several days before death relieves its suffering. So far as we can see, the fawn's intense suffering is pointless. Now, I think the point is pretty obvious. If human beings are guilty of a bad act of free will, as Adam and Eve were supposed to have been, why should this fawn or that dog have to pay for our sins? And of course, Rowe is also a rhetorician, so he imagined a very cute animal, a fawn, and it lives not in the city, but in some distant forest, and not connected with the human world. It's a natural event that kills the fawn, lightning that starts a fire, and the fawn does not only die, it suffers and then dies belatedly. Where is the redemption here? Now, just one last thought. I meant to show this yesterday, so I'm going to do it now. Talking about the origin of ethics, this picture is striking. These elephants join trunks over the cadaver of a dead relative. They seem to be mourning. So raises the question of where ethics come from. And there have been suggestions from Darwin and Mary Midgley, among others, that there are precursors of ethics in animals, and here are some sites. You can look those up later. All right. So now we can imagine a hypothetical state in which there was no such thing as disease or death. Of course, in a way, we know that's not possible. Even in the most hypothetical of prelapsarian situations, and this poem is the Garden of Eden as imagined by John Milton in Paradise Lost. And even Adam and Eve are shown eating. So even if they were vegetarians, the plants from which they got their food, you know, parts of the plant had to die, the cells had to die. Now in this epic poem, Milton actually has God the Father speak, and C.S. Lewis wrote a commentary on this, a long preface to Paradise Lost, and he accused Milton of showing very poor taste in having God the Father speak. And I must say that as great as Milton's poem is, otherwise, I kind of agree with what Lewis says here. But anyway, in Paradise Lost, after the disobedience of Adam and Eve, God the Father surveys the situation. Adam and Eve realize they've done wrong and sincerely repent of their bad act. The Son of God, called this, and not by his earthly name, Jesus, pleads for mercy on their behalf. And although the Father is sympathetic to the Son's plea for mercy, he's adamant. He says here, "Die he or justice must." He has a higher obligation to justice than to mercy, says God the Father. Okay, So here's the rub. Posterity seems to include not only all human beings descended from Adam and Eve, but also other creatures. And the pain of Eve and her descendants in childbirth is to be compounded by the pain of the fawn burning in the distant forest fire after lightning strike. And it is compounded by the balanced polymorphism of the hemoglobin S gene and the banding pattern of the Grove snail. But when we come to biology, one of the central tenets is the unity of the biome, that human beings have traits common to all biological creatures. Now, in this context, I want to turn to one aspect of Thomas Aquinas's writings on evil. It's been called metaphysical evil. I don't know if that's a good term or not, but it stems basically from our and every creature's imperfection or lacks. Our susceptibility to disease, the inevitability of death, might be thought of in this context as biological tough luck. Now, Thomas Aquinas divided evil into pena and culpa. Again, pena is either pain or punishment. And he defined that as the evil which comes from the withdrawal of the form and integrity of the thing, and it has the nature of pain. Okay, think of a cavity in a tooth, for example. It's a defect in the form, a hole in the tooth, but it's not just a hole, it's infected. Culpa, or fault, is possible only in creatures with free will. And this is something that, as different a philosopher as Immanuel Kant, agreed with completely. Thomas said that culpa is the evil which consists in the subtraction of the due operation in voluntary things. If we're automata, there's no good or evil. There may be pleasure and pain, but there's no good and evil. For this is imputed to anyone as a fault, to fail as regards perfect action of which he is the master by will. And we'll have to parse that out at some point, the master of the will, taking Freud into account. So Thomas noted that a mere absence is not an evil. It is an evil for a human being not to be able to see, but it's not evil for a stone not to be able to see, because sight is not part of the nature of a stone. And that's where biological tough luck comes in. Biological creatures are imperfect, and they're in competition with one another, all defective in their form in some way. Some are stronger, smarter, more beautiful, whatever, than others. And now let's think about human beings versus COVID. We succumb to COVID because these other things, COVID or E. coli, is trying to perfect its own form, and that it happens to do so at our expense is not the fault of E. coli. And it's not just biology. Thomas also saw the competition in fire versus air or water. He says that a fire destroys the air or a house or whatever, and that evil and corruption befall air and water, as he says, comes from the perfection of the fire. All right, the fire is trying to perfect its form, because the fire does not aim at the privation of the form of water or house, but at the bringing in of its own form. Though by doing this, it also accidentally causes the other to have harm. All right? So the fire destroys the house. It's just trying to do its thing. It happens to destroy the house. And this is an accident, as he called it. And it's, you know, no consolation to a person with long COVID or whatever disease that the COVID is trying to perfect its own form and only harms us accidentally. Okay, so now I come to three final questions, and they're big ones. So let's start with this one. When we think about the science of disease, where does the privative argument lead to? And then I'll talk a little bit about disease and original sin, and then originals come back to the topic of original sin in the area, in the era of biology. So I think... We come to the question, what is a disease? And as I think you know, it's it. Yeah, so evil is the privation of the good in a subject. Evil is the privation of the good in a subject. And he is basically quoting Augustine and Dionysius and a number of other authors on this question. And I have to stop here to say that this is a point that I've tried to teach, and students have a lot of trouble with it, and that they're not wrong in having trouble with it. It's very easy to misunderstand, and that is even before you get to the question of whether it's right or wrong. So one can disagree with the privative theory of evil if you like, but let's take careful note of what Augustine and Aquinas were not saying. They were not saying that evil is only an illusion, or that evil is only in the mind, or there's really no such thing as evil in the world. Quite the contrary, in fact. You might as well say that there's no such thing as a cavity in a tooth, because it's just a hole. Well, just not the way it is. What they meant by this statement was quite specific. It is that evil is not a thing in itself with a nature or essence. And, you know, there's much more to say about that, but I think we need to move on. But there's one other point I want to make before we do. And why do we have so much trouble with this idea? And Thomas anticipates this. He says, one opposite is known through the other, as darkness is known through light. Now, you ask a person, what is light? You might say something about photons. And leaving aside the possibility that there is such a thing as a dark photon, basically what most people mean when they talk about dark is the absence of light. But we know light and dark as opposites. That's the way we know them. So the important thing that Thomas does here is he distinguishes the plane of knowing, knowledge, from the plane of being. Okay? The plane of knowing versus being. So we know opposites from one another. Okay, so now let's get to the privative theory and how it can be applied to disease on the scientific level. And from teaching medical students their pathology for many, many years, decades, what I realized, slowly but surely, is that the theory works pretty darn well in the science. Okay, now this is a lung cancer, two different cases of lung cancer. One is it looks in the organ, and the other, the way it looks in a microscope. And you can see the cancer in the center there. It looks ugly, and it is ugly. And I think you can extend, I'm going to talk about cancer a little bit, but you can extend this to infectious diseases, or heart disease, atherosclerosis, or Alzheimer's disease. And in my book, which is, you know, under review at the moment, this is a point I elaborate on. Now, we have a lot of trouble thinking about cancer as privative because it's forceful, it's invasive. We use words like invasive to describe it. But let's look at the facts. A cancer is a growth of abnormal cells that divide without normal controls. And this is caused by the accumulation of non-lethal mutations in the genes that would normally regulate cell growth and differentiation. In other words, it's about the loss of these functions. Okay, and so the genes that typically are mutated in cancer, proto-oncogenes that regulate growth, tumor suppressor genes that also regulate growth, cells of apoptosis, which regulate a process called programmed cell death, DNA repair genes so that mutations accumulate. These are the common mutations. And if you go down the list of what is found in the cancer phenotype, all of them can be accounted by the loss of a normal function. And I mean all of them can be accounted for by the loss of a normal function. So here are the features of the malignant phenotype. Cells are not supposed to grow without the right signals, but cancer cells do because they've lost regulation, and so forth and so on. And again, this is something that I will be glad to elaborate on if you would like. Okay, so the second of my final points returns to the relationship, if any, between disease and original sin. Now, I think for the reasons I described, it's difficult for a lot of people to accept the idea that disease and death entered the world with Adam and Eve. And I think there's another and subtler way to understand this point, which is the point that Thomas Aquinas gave us. Thomas warns us against making any simple and straightforward one-to-one connection between an individual's suffering and his or her individual sins. And this quote is from his literal exposition on the book of Job. And Job's sufferings, of course, included many things, but among them are diseases. As the text says, he was, quote, afflicted with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Now, those of you who are very conversant with the book of Job know that Job was patient only in the first two chapters of the book, and then very briefly at the end. But starting with chapter 3, he's anything but patient. He really wants to know, what has he done to deserve his suffering? And then the three friends come in, and, you know, as they say, with friends like these, who needs enemies? So they are far from sympathetic, so I prefer to call them interlocutors rather than friends. But here's what Thomas Aquinas says about the first of these friends, whose name is Eliphaz. He says, if it were true, as Eliphaz says, was trying to claim, that the proper punishment of sins were the adversities of the present life, it would follow that men would suffer grave adversities because of grave sins and light adversities because of light sins. And so just men would never be subjected to grave adversities, which is patently false. I mean, it's not just false, it's patently false. It's so obviously false that the good suffer and the evil prosper at times. We know this. We all know this. So what does Thomas say about this? I mean, he says that about bodily sickness, he says that it is partly a privation, okay, as insofar as it denotes the destruction of the equilibrium of health. Now, and then he says it is, consequently, it is not a pure privation, but a corrupt habit. Okay, now, basically, this makes original sin something other than an act. Okay, an act is voluntary. Adam and Eve might have misused their free will, but what about the rest of us? The problem is, where was I? Yeah. At the same time, we are far from exculpated because we have gotten something of the original sin, not the act itself, but the privation and corruption of our natures. Okay, so Thomas Aquinas, living in the 13th century, St. Paul, living, you know, roughly 1,200 years or so before that, they had no reason to doubt that Adam and Eve were one person. Adam was one man. We don't have to be quite so literal about it, but Thomas Aquinas was literal. But the question is this: does the doctrine of original sin suffer in any way if one says that there really was no single first human being, for a single man and woman? And I think Thomas Aquinas's article on original sin sheds a rather interesting light on this question by asking, how is it that the sin of the first parent got transmitted? And he treats it almost like a scientific question. He goes to the current science of his day, which mostly was Aristotelian, but he thinks about, well, is it transmitted with the seed, for example? Is it a kind of infection? He thinks about these kinds of things. And I don't think we need to dwell on the outdated, rather arcane biology here. We can cut him some slack here and try to understand what he's really saying here. So how does one resolve this dilemma here? He's discussing the question of how it is that the corruption of Adam is transmitted to descendants. We in the modern era would speak about the mechanism. How does original sin get transmitted to the descendants of Adam? And this is a question, this is a question whether you think there's a single atom or many, many atoms. In other words, many precursors of the modern human species. So as I say in this quote, he rejects as erroneous the argument about something physical happening to the seed, and his biology of reproduction is way, way out of date. We don't need to worry about that. But again, he comes back to the point that a sin is an act of the will. And in this, again, this is not just Thomas Aquinas who says this. So how does he explain it? And come to this quote. And here's this very interesting comment, I think. He says, and again, it does not require us to believe that Adam and Eve were a single historical individual. Therefore, we must explain the matter otherwise, because these biological explanations don't really work, by saying that all men born of Adam may be considered as one man, inasmuch as they have one common nature, which they received from their first parents, even as in civil matters, all who are members of one community are reputed as one body and the whole community as one man. And he quotes Porphyry. Okay, so in other words, what is original sin? It is a condition of human nature. Okay, now we'll come back to Brothers Karamazov, and I'm again not going to quote the whole thing. And this is a very graphic, disturbing passage concerning nailing a person's ears to a fence. But what Ivan says about this, and I think when we're talking about human nature, we have to take this into account. No beast could ever be so cruel as a man, so artfully, so artistically cruel. A tiger simply gnaws and tears. That is all he can do. It would never occur to him to nail people by their ears overnight, even if he were able to do it. Graphic, disturbing passage. Of course, Dostoevsky, as a Russian patriot, was harder on Turks than on Russians. But I think the point is not the difference between Turks or Russians, it's the difference between human beings and tigers. Ivan's point is that in a way, human beings are worse than tigers, because when human beings are cruel, it's by choice. Let me add that this is an example of what Thomas called morose delectation, because what he misses is that human beings can also be better than tigers. Okay, they can also be good. And here's where I meant to show the slide of the elephants mourning. I'll show it again because I like it so much. Okay. So whatever is the case with higher mammals, elephants, dogs, horses, goats, choose your favorite higher mammal, I think original sin defines what human nature is. I don't think any other animal can have, there may be other things as well, but I don't think any other animal, you know, maybe there's precursors of morality in other animals, but human beings have free will, have morality, and that defines to a large extent what we are. And my last point also returns to Brothers Karamazov, and this is something that almost serves as an anthem for Father Zosima. And this is the elder with whom Alyosha is getting his moral formation at the monastery. He says, love one another, fathers, love God's people. And he goes on and says, why do we love them? Because we are guilty for all and before all. All right. So this is Father Zosima says to the other monks as he is dying, each of us is undoubtedly guilty on behalf of all and for all on earth, not only because of the common guilt of the word, but personally responsible. Each one of us, for all people and for each people on this earth. This, by the way, is a liturgical formula in the Russian Orthodox Church. Last point here, that the text uses this word vinovat, which means to be guilty or blameworthy, but Zosima makes five statements in which he incorporates this liturgical formula. And the point, I think, is that guilt entails responsibility. It's not enough to feel guilty. You've got to do something about it. You're responsible for doing something about it. So Russian makes this point very forcefully. The word in Russia and Russian, the two words that are used here, mean both guilt and responsibility. And when I talk about responsibility, I mean not to the rich and powerful particularly, but to human beings and the least of us. And I'll show this last picture here, which is of Augusta Dee, who was the patient studied by Alois Alzheimer. I study Alzheimer in the lab, disease in the lab. And this was the first patient that Alois Alzheimer studied with the disease, an early onset form of the disease. You can see I see her as having a forlorn expression. She doesn't really know what's going on in the world. And, you know, she doesn't know who she is necessarily, even though she does have some concept of I. She doesn't really know much more than that. And I think the responsibility we owe is to people like this. Okay.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.